Well, somehow by God's providence, I was given the section in James 5 to teach about the rich again. Wasn't it just a few months ago that I taught on James 2 about our attitudes on the poor? Coincidence? I don't think so. But this passage today looks at not just how misusing our wealth can hurt others, but it shows how we lay up for ourselves the burning wrath of a holy God when we abuse our wealth. I want to start out by giving you some statistics which I found interesting, mainly because as a typical American, I honestly don't pay attention to the numbers that tell the story of the poor of the world. So let's start by talking about millions, or millionaires to be exact. The most popular country for millionaires to live in is, any guess? The United States. Out of our population of almost 319 million people, 5.8 million households are worth at least 1 million. Now, let's talk about billionaires. According to a Forbes article released just yesterday, the number of billionaires worldwide in 2015 now stands at, any guesses? 1,826 billionaires in the world. Now, just some tidbits about billionaires. The richest living person is, any guesses?
Bill Gates.
Bill Gates, very good. His total net worth is $79 billion, and that's after giving a $1.5 billion gift to his foundation just in November. And he's held that title for 16 of the past 21 years. Well, there's a billionaire named, and I'm not kidding, God Nisanov, something like that. God was born in Azerbaijan, and he moved to Moscow and made his fortune building shopping markets near metro stations. And there's a billionaire from France who reportedly owns over 1,000 comic books. And another billionaire from Turkey, who made his fortune in beer, has a collection of more than 3,000 pens. And I'm sure we're not just talking about Bic or Papermate here. And he carries them with him in a suitcase. So, are these just hobbies? Or are they abusive wealth? Well, I'm sure they don't even compare to the abusive wealth we see with most billionaires and their indulgences of mansions, private jets, spas, jewelry, you name it. So just last week on NBC's website, I read about an American billionaire who was going through a divorce, and they had to state their filings for the child support. Kid you not, this was straight out of it. $160,000 a month for vacation rentals, $300,000 a month for private jet travel, $6,800 a month for groceries. That's more than my yearly budget. $7,200 for restaurant meals a month, $8,000 a month for gifts, $2,000 a month for stationery, and that was important enough to put it in the divorce decree, and four nannies for three kids. You know, for the majority of us, this is absolutely astounding, but perhaps as Christians, we're the only ones who see it, that something's wrong with this. So the following information is from the Credit Suisse World Wealth Report in 2014. I forgot to bring it, but there's a picture of it being a triangle, okay? So just a triangle. If you were to take the world's population and categorize it by wealth and put it in this triangle or pyramid, you would see that there are 35 million people, or just 0.7% of the population, at the teeny tiny tip, who own $115.9 trillion. That's 0.7%, less than 1% of the world's population represents 44% of the global wealth. Now, at the other extreme, take this bottom. There are 3.3 billion individuals at the bottom of this pyramid, making up less than 3% of global riches, despite representing nearly 70% of the population. So this teeny tiny tip of millionaires, less than 1%, own more than the poorest 3.3 billion, putting together the base of that pyramid. Well, what about the middle? Right? There's those that are in the middle. Most of us would think that we fall somewhere in that, right? Do you know what that middle cutoff is for it to be in that upper 30% of population in terms of wealth? In other words, do you know how much money you would need to be considered in the top 30% of the wealthy, richest people in the world? Take a stab at that. $10,000 is sufficient to be in the top 30%. I can't even begin to think of what life would be like on $10,000 a year. What kind of living conditions would we be in? How much food could we actually buy? You know, I think deep down, living on that small amount of money scares us to death. I know it does me. And truth be told, these numbers may actually be inflated. It may be worse than that. David Platt cited another website called I Remember the Poor. And on it, they state that if you made $1,500 a year, you are in the top 20% of the world's income earners. Let's put that in perspective. That means my 16-year-old son, Bennett, will make more this year working part-time fast food at Zaxby's than 80% of the rest of the world. The website goes on to say that if you make $50,000 annually, you are in the top 1% of the world's income earners. So, let's go back to our pyramid and not David's numbers. This is where more than 3/4 of the world live, in that 70% bottom bracket. They don't even have enough for basic necessities. And in stark contrast, that upper 20% or even 30%, that includes you and I, everyone in this room, have more than enough for ourselves and for those around us. It's a simple fact. We live in the wealthiest nation in the world. We just saw that. And historically, we live in the wealthiest nation in the history of the world. We are the wealthiest Christians in the history of the world. So no matter where your income is in this congregation, in that pyramid, you and I are still among the wealthiest Christians to have ever walked on this planet. So it's no surprise that James turns to address this problem, and I call it a problem because that's what James calls it. If it weren't a problem, he wouldn't tell us to weep and mourn over it. James takes the opportunity to address those in the congregation who are living for their money. While James is still writing to the church, he was probably addressing non-believers here, those who were claiming to be Christians, but their lifestyles proved otherwise. Either way, it's good for both Christians and non-Christians alike to hear these words. So let's read James 5, 1 through 6. Come now, you rich, weep and howl for the miseries that are coming upon you. Your riches have rotted, and your garments are moth-eaten. Your gold and silver have corroded, and their corrosion will be evidence against you, and will eat your flesh like fire. You have laid up treasures in the last day. Behold, the wages of the laborers who mowed your fields, which you kept back by fraud, are crying out against you, and the cries of the harvesters have reached the ears of the Lord of hosts. You have lived on the earth in luxury and in self-indulgence. You have fattened your hearts in a day of slaughter. You have condemned, you have murdered the righteous person. He does not resist you. So this first part of chapter 5 is directed at those rich pretenders in the church who want to be known as followers of Christ, but whose real God is money. And these rich people, simply by their use of and abuse of money and material things, showed utter disregard for God and for His Word. They demonstrated that in spite of their claim of being a Christian, they love their money more. Their life is totally controlled and governed by that love of money, and so their spiritual state is revealed in the matter of their relationship to these riches. These wealthy are those people who hoard their possessions precisely because they trust in those possessions instead of trusting in God. But what they forget is that wealth will not last. Contrary to the bumper sticker, he who dies with the most toys does not win. For believers, our use of wealth is an important spiritual indicator and may reveal the presence of worldliness in our hearts. Just as James has given us tests of our spiritual condition throughout the book so far in regards to trials, relationships, works, and time, again, he is giving us another test to help reveal the condition of our hearts, our value of money. In his book, Systematic Theology, Wayne Grudem wrote, "The more Christians are caught up in enjoying the good things of this life, and the more they neglect genuine Christian fellowship and their personal relationship with Christ, the less they will long for His return. On the other hand, many Christians who are experiencing suffering or persecution, or who are more elderly and infirm, and those whose daily walk with Christ is vital and deep will have a more intense longing for his return. Grudem goes on to say, to some extent then, the degree to which we actually long for Christ's return is a measure of the spiritual condition of our own lives at the moment. And we saw last time at the end of James 4 that there's nothing wrong with planning, remember? So too, we see this week that there's nothing wrong with money. Even Jesus counted some rich people among his followers, such as Zacchaeus, Joseph of Arimathea, and Barnabas, and remember Job was wealthy. Wealth is a gift from God, and God blesses us in different ways, giving some of us more and some of us less than others. It's not wrong to possess money, and it's not sinful in and of itself. Proverbs 10:22 states, "It is a blessing of the Lord that makes rich, and he adds no sorrow to it." And the Bible does not teach us that we cannot enjoy wealth that the Lord has given us. Listen to what Paul writes in 1 Timothy 6:17. "Instruct those who are rich in this present world not to be conceited or to fix their hope on the uncertainty of riches, but on God, who richly supplies us with all things to enjoy." God is the one who has blessed us with wealth, and he actually wants us to enjoy what he has given us. So, if wealth is not the problem, and if the enjoyment of wealth is not the problem, then what is the problem? The love of money is the problem. 1 Timothy 6:10 states, "The love of money is the root of all sorts of evil. It is through this craving that some have wandered away from the faith and pierced themselves with many pangs." Ouch! Paul is telling Timothy that because some loved money so much, they fell away and are experiencing eternal wrath for temporary riches. What is vital for us as believers to see in this passage is that the desire for wealth and its attainment could lure Christians, yes, even you and me, away from their devotion to Christ and love of the body. Again, wealth is not the enemy of James's assault here. Instead, it's going after the misuse of wealth. Wealth itself is neutral, but it can also be compared to a fire. Used properly and under control, wealth is a helpful tool. It can be used to provide for the poor, build orphanages, sustain missionaries, distribute gospel literature. But if it's used carelessly or with evil intent, it can become destructive. When combined with our fallen, greedy, selfish human heart, money can quickly corrupt. It can be abused by those who will abuse others, indulge in sensuality, and control nations. Here in this passage, James shows three ways that wealth can become a trap and that leads to spiritual destruction. First, he addresses the issue of hoarding. In James's time, there were three main indicators of wealth. First, there was grain, and you could store it in large bins or silos. Remember the story about the guy building more silos? These rich people had so much stuff that it was rotting in storage. What good are silos full of grain if when you go to get a bag, it's spoiled or full of mold or infested with bugs? These wealthy farmers stuffed all they could find in their silos that they might have room for getting even more. They held on to their grain until it rotted and was useless for anyone. And second, there was clothing. In a world where most of the poor only had the clothes on their backs, it was a sign of wealth to have more than one change of clothes. And they crammed their closets with the finest of garments, only to be ruined by moths. And again, what good are 10 changes of clothes if you go to get something out of the closet and it's got holes all over it? And third, there was gold and silver. They hid and hoarded their gold and silver until these non-rusting metals began to rust. They held on to their gold and silver for so long that it wasn't even good to give as an inheritance. And I think we can find many good reasons in this passage why hoarding is a sin. It's a sin because it's an improper use of God's wealth. God gives us more money than we need so that we can give generously. When we hoard and keep it for ourselves, we are sinfully misusing the wealth that the Lord has given us. Another reason hoarding might be a sin is because it perhaps speaks of a person who finds his satisfaction in things rather than God. They find their security and their trust in material things instead of trusting in the giver of all good things. And lastly, hoarding can be a sin because it shows no awareness of God's scrutiny and final judgment, that one day he will come and take an account of the way we've managed the gifts that he has given us. Those who are hoarders don't realize it, but the very things that they hoard will rise up and give testimony against them in the last days. It says, the rust is a witness against you when you face God. The stuff will testify to your hoarding. And the ruin of the things the rich hoarded is a graphic picture of their own destruction. Their hoarded, rotted, moth-eaten, rusted riches will give loud testimony to the state of their heart. All that hoarded wealth is witness for the prosecution, declaring their guilt and the just God to condemn them to hell. But in a merciful plea, James is giving the rich much grace in considering that final judgment to come. He's telling them that even though they have temporary comfort and ease, without God, they have long-term misery. The ungodly rich mistakenly think that they are relieving themselves and their families from hardships through their wealth and possessions. But James says instead that they are storing up misery and hardship and destruction in the final judgment. Their treasures on earth will bring about their torment and eternity, and the very thing that they're trusting in for comfort now will result in their final misery. Now, obviously, don't get me wrong, we as Christians are to provide for our families. We see this in 1 Timothy 5:8. But if anyone does not provide for his own, and especially for those of his household, he has denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever. But beyond the care of our earthly family, we are also to provide for the physical needs of our spiritual family, just as the early church in Acts did. And the Proverbs continually exhort us to work hard, to save, and to store up for that day of trouble. But it never gives us permission to hoard, to be self-indulgent, and to make wealth an end in itself. There is a difference between wise saving for the future, which the Bible admonishes us to do, and the greedy, self-centered hoarding for the present. One looks at wealth as a means to sustain the believer in service to God. But the other looks at wealth as everything, as security in life. Think back with me to the great stock market crash of 1929, which marked the beginning of the 10-year Great Depression. What led up to the crash? Well, I'm not really knowledgeable on it, but to simplify, the Roaring Twenties was a time of wealth and excess. And those are not my words, that came straight from Wikipedia. Where do you go? Wikipedia, right? Rural Americans immigrated to the cities in vast numbers throughout the decade in the hopes of finding a more prosperous life in the ever-growing expansion of America's industrial sector. More and more people invested their life savings into the stock market and even borrowed to buy stocks to make quick money. While the American cities prospered, this created widespread financial despair among American farmers. Production began to decline, construction was sluggish, sales slowed, and consumers racked up debt because of easy credit. Confidence was lost in the stock market, as many financiers bought and sold large quantities of stock so quickly that no one knew at what price they were being sold or bought at. Creditors called in their debts, and no one could pay. And after a rocky year, the market crashed in October 1929 and lost over $30 billion in the space of 2 days. That's 1929 money. And what was the outcome? Of course, the Great Depression was the ultimate result, with 12 million people out of work. But what I want you to see that ties to our lesson is the result on the individuals. Suicide rates steadily increased from 1925 to 1932. One source says that by 1932, 17 people out of every 100,000 people committed suicide. Men who had put their trust in the temporary security of wealth, either through the stock market or their jobs, could not bear to face life without money. So as Jesus himself warns us in Matthew 6:19-21, do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal, but lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust destroys and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. True wealth is found only in those things that we carry on into eternity. You want to tell me where your heart is? Show me where your treasure is. Where are you stockpiling that treasure? Where are you placing your wealth? Now, while we do have a responsibility to provide for our families and to be adequately prepared for our future needs, we must not live for these things nor put our trust in them. If the attention of our lives centers on the temporal and momentary, then we are surely neglecting what matters most. And what is it that matters most, you may ask? Matthew 6:33 gives our answer. But seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things will be added unto you. Obviously, when God prospers you and me and gives us more than we need, he does it that we might use it properly for his glory and to advance his kingdom. Our wealth should be used to win the lost. As John MacArthur said, I can't think of anything better to do with money than to invest it in those who labor to win the lost. This could be missionaries, pastors, evangelists, and even laymen. Scripture also says, use your money to care for the needy. In Matthew 25, Jesus says of his sheep, for I was hungry, and you gave me food. I was thirsty, and you gave me drink. I was a stranger, and you welcomed me. And I was naked, and you clothed me. And they asked, when? And he goes on to say, you did it to the least of these. Someone who is living for their moment and is a slave to their money would not be willing to part with it for a stranger. You see, out of our excess that the Lord has blessed us with, we ought to find ways to give back to the kingdom, finding the needy to clothe, to feed, to water, and to share the love of Christ with. And just a caveat, rich people need Christ too. It's not just the poor, but that's our focus here. So moving on in verse 4, James goes on to talk about the corruption of the wealthy. In the ancient world, the concentration of land was in the hands of the few landowners who would, in satisfying themselves, oftentimes neglect their workers' wages. Laborers would be paid at the end of each day, and they had no savings or credit cards upon which they could rely. Each day's work was enough for meager food supplies for the laborer and his family. And if the landowner failed to pay at the end of the day, the worker and his family would go hungry the next day. And James accuses them of holding out wages that they owe to the laborers who mowed the fields. He basically says to them, your rusting, rotting possessions are accumulating while people are dying of hunger. So James says that those wages, just like the rust of those precious metals, are crying out against them. And who are they crying to? To the Lord of hosts, literally the Lord of the armies on high. God delights in showing his power and his greatness by hearing the poor and coming to their aid, by defending those who are needy and delivering them. James is reminding them that they could trust that even though they were being treated unjustly in their lives day after day after day, the justice of God was coming. Woe to these rich landowners, for instead of storing up wealth, they are actually storing up God's wrath, because that day of final judgment is coming. And instead of preparing their hearts for that day of judgment, James says that they are steadily making it worse for themselves. He says that they are living in luxury and self-indulgence. The words used paint a picture of a life of ease. That is the meaning of luxuriously, a soft life. It's not necessarily evil, but it is devoid of any sense of sacrifice or labor. Again, he's not condemning those who are rich and who have been blessed with an easy life, but instead those whose pursuit is pleasure. Those who are controlled by pleasure and go out of their way to find things to make their lives even more pleasurable. They are fattening their hearts in a day of slaughter. And the picture here is like a dumb, fat cow eating grass outside the meat processing plant. He has no idea what will be coming the next day as he is herded up the ramp to be slaughtered. He just goes about his business, indulging in all the grass that he can while judgment is at the door. What a scary picture to think you will hear the words, well done, good and faithful servant, and instead hear, depart from me, I never knew you. And lastly, James uses one final example to express his condemnation to the wealthy. He points out that there are those who have even condemned and murdered in order to gain wealth. And James speaking in general here about taking advantage of someone who doesn't resist or fight back, perhaps because they can't. In the Jewish world, to deprive a person of their support and to hold back their wages was the same as murdering them. In their luxury and self-indulgence, they satiated themselves upon all the fine things in life, and all the while they were condemning and murdering innocent men. Now they will face the Creator as judge. Their wealth cannot buy their way out of the intensity of divine punishment for their abuse of riches. And all this time they've been storing up the riches on the earth, they have been multiplying their miseries to come in the last days. Those who have not known misery in this life, yet who cause such great misery on the part of the poor, are going to encounter a far greater misery than they can ever imagine. And I want to remind you that there are very godly rich people and very greedy sinful people. Money doesn't change the heart, only God does. Now these warnings that James gives us serve three main purposes, I thought. First, they should encourage us to be faithful and endure, knowing that in due time he will judge these wicked. It's hard to remain faithful, especially when we see others prospering, like in Psalms. It's hard to keep your eyes focused on the eternal prize and not those things that will someday burn away. James tells us, keep at it. Jesus is worth it. And second, it should warn us not to fall into any of these sins that will bring judgment on the wicked. Any Christian, we've heard this before, is capable of any sin at any time. And if we are indeed the richest people to live on the face of the earth in human history, then we of all people need to live in a heightened awareness of sins and entanglements relating to wealth. And relatedly, third, our responsibility is to be faithful to God in the realm of financial stewardship. You either trust in money that you now see or in the Lord that you will see one day. And if you trust in the Lord, you will be a good steward of the money and possessions that he entrusts to you. He owns it all. We must give an account to him of how we used it. Jesus goes on to say in Luke 16:10, he who is faithful in a very little thing is faithful also in much, and he who is unrighteous in a very little thing is unrighteous also in much. And in that context, the very little thing could be money. I want to end by telling you a story that I read about a criminal in Missouri 7 years ago who tried to steal a TV from Walmart. According to the newspaper, he found a water bottle worth $3.16, and he peeled off the barcode and he attached that sticker to a $500 TV that he wanted. You can see where this is going. He took the TV to the checkout and he tried to buy it for $3.16. And when the clerk questioned the very low price, the man insisted that the barcode and price was correct. He was so determined to buy the TV for the price of the water bottle that the store called the police and the man was arrested and charged for attempted theft through deceit. And if you're like me, you're thinking, why in the world would this man think that the checkout clerk would be dumb enough to sell him a television for $3.16? To pull a stunt like that, you'd have to think that everyone was as foolish as you were, or be very greedy and self-deceived. And yet, somehow the devil manages to pull off that same scheme with remarkable success. He plays the same trick on us regularly. He changes the value of things. He switches the price tags. He makes us think that the really important and really valuable things in life are cheap and worthless, and that the cheap and meaningless things in life are really valuable and necessary. Somehow, he gets people to invest their whole lives in something that has no enduring value, while at the same time neglecting the things that are eternal. The brevity of life that we talked about last time sets the stage for the wealthy to realize that wealth, just like life, is fleeting. Yet we spend so much time and energy trying to amass wealth and manage that wealth and plan for future wealth, and we don't even notice that the price tags have been switched. So take heart. Find strength in the fact that Christ has already borne the sins that we've committed when it comes to our finances. Even when it comes to mistakes with our money, there is no condemnation for those who are in Christ Jesus. The robe of Christ's perfect righteousness cannot be eaten by moths, nor will the golden streets of heaven ever rust or become tarnished. We have a wealth that is earned not by the sweat of exploited laborers, but through the bloody sweat of the Son of God, who perfectly obeyed the commandments of God. He alone offers a wealth which justifies us before God and allows us to live in His very presence forever.